Welcome back to Microdigressions. This is Spencer Case, and it's been a very long gap since our last episode, unfortunately, and I'm happy to finally get to do this last one of 2020. There'll be many more to come in 2021, I am certain, but there were some glitches and there were some complications that prevented me from getting this last one out earlier, and in part had to do with me moving back to China, which I was finally able to do in November. And now I've got an apartment in Wuhan, had to be quarantined for a couple weeks, but I'm glad to be through that. And I'm here today with my friend Tyler Paytas. How are you doing, Tyler?
Great, Spencer. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really good. You are the first repeat guest on this podcast. So
it's an honor. Congratulations. Thank you for the invitation. I was happy to be able to talk with you again.
Cool. Yeah, I always appreciate the combination of rigor and intensity and, more recently, applicability that you bring to the conversation. You've moved from some more sort of abstract themes in your thinking to some really applied stuff, like the stuff on anger and a little bit fear that we're going to get into today.
Yeah, that's right. And I thank Epictetus for that, for teaching me to focus on the more important things.
Cool. So, a couple updates for the show. We've hit 2,000 downloads, even though I haven't been uploading new content for a few months. There's still been downloads. We hit the 2,000 download mark, and we are now on Pandora. So that's good news. Also, Tyler's got some career updates, I believe, right?
Yeah, I accepted a position. I'm staying with ACU, with Australian Catholic University, but I recently accepted a position as senior lecturer in the North Sydney campus. So I'm currently in Melbourne, but I'll be moving to Sydney at the end of January. And we're starting a new program in Western civilization, and I'll be teaching philosophy courses within that program. And I'm really excited about it. It should be a lot of fun.
That sounds awesome. That sounds awesome. So I initially wanted to have this conversation with you about anger before the election, because I thought it was like an especially pressing issue then. Oh, but it looks like I need not have worried. Like, it's still with us.
Right.
And there's a new occasion, which is the beginning of the new year, right? Ever there's a time for people to reflect on their own dispositions and attitudes and self-improvement. You know, it's the beginning of the new year. I don't know how often people stick to resolutions they make, but, you know, you'd think that this would be a good time for such reflection.
So, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you've been lately pushing a kind of an ancient view about anger and about fear that puts both of these sort of emotions in a more hostile light. Why don't you just say a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I think, you know, one thing that I've learned as of recently, like through my reading of the Roman Stoics especially, is just that the sort of modern tendency, especially among academic philosophers, to sort of valorize our emotional responses, especially when they're fitting in the sense of having some sort of accurate appraisal. I think that's misguided. And I think there's good reason to be more skeptical of our emotional responses for a lot of different reasons. One of the main reasons is just that I think that they can interfere with our ability to reason soundly and make good decisions. And people often talk about, well, you should just control them. But once you let an emotion like anger arise, the prospect of just sort of controlling it and making sure that it doesn't carry you away or make you to lead you towards bad decisions, that's not a very promising strategy in my view. So I think a better goal is to try to cultivate myself such that I'm less likely to have an anger response in the first place. And similar things apply to other emotions like fear, envy, etc.
To be clear, you're not just saying that we should be on guard against excessive anger. Like one, like fairly traditional view is that anger is just fine in the appropriate amounts and appropriate circumstances. It's just sort of like it's rage or sort of like a disproportionate, excessive, or otherwise sort of perverted form of anger that's the real enemy. You want to make a more comprehensive critique of anger, if I understand you correctly.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think even when it's, you know, not taken to the extreme, I still feel like it has problematic features. One problematic feature is what I was just alluding to, the fact that it can sort of amplify our cognitive biases and make it easier for us to underestimate the effects of our behavior. And, you know, if I'm in an ambiguous situation where it's not clear what somebody's intentions were, if I'm in a state of anger, I'm more likely to attribute malicious intentions to them. So you've got these cognitive distorting effects that come about via anger. But I also think that there's something intrinsically problematic about it, which is that it has this attitude or feeling of animosity or a withdrawal of goodwill towards the other person, towards the target of your anger. And in my view, there's something intrinsically disvaluable about that. So again, even if your anger is not sort of out of control rage, if you're having a genuine anger response, I feel like that does involve some amount of hostility towards another person. And in my view, there's something intrinsically disvaluable about that. I don't think that it's ever good to feel hostility or animosity or any sort of desire to retaliate. You can disapprove strongly of what someone did, and you can take action to try to defend yourself or defend other people, defend the vulnerable. But I don't think that we need anger with its retaliation aspect and its animosity sort of sentiment. I don't think that we need any of that. I think there's something problematic about it.
So does this view of anger then rely on like a rejection of retributivism, the idea that it's good to harm the wicked or to punish people who do bad things, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I've actually just recently been thinking about this. So I personally do reject retributivism. And I initially thought that, you know, my view was sort of tied to that rejection of retributivism. But lately, I've been thinking that maybe you can be a sort of retributivist who at the same time rejects anger, where there's sort of like the idea is that it's somehow good from the standpoint of cosmic justice for the wrongdoer, for the transgressor to be punished and to experience some suffering. Like maybe there's some sort of intrinsic value to the scales of cosmic justice being balanced in that way. But I feel like you could possibly have that view while also thinking that I shouldn't be angry at the person. I shouldn't sort of think of this as like I'm getting payback or revenge. You know, I've somehow lost any feeling of goodwill towards that person. It's more just about this dispassionate cosmic justice idea, which I think is a weird idea. I'm not sympathetic to it, but I think you could have that view and still be like accept the anti-anger view that I'm putting forth. I think most retributivists, though, do have this sort of stronger, you know, it's payback and there's some sort of satisfaction that I take in seeing you suffering because that's what you deserve in this more, you know, payback retaliation sense. And I'm deeply skeptical of that.
So certainly, I'm definitely willing to go with you this far. I think like most of the time, anger is bad. It's a cognitive distortion. And if you want to see how cognitively distorting it is, think about anger at things that are inanimate. I've talked to you about this before, but I'm not sure. Does the phenomenology of anger actually cause me to like attribute these animistic beliefs or have these animalistic beliefs about my computer wants to harm me by restarting when I don't want it to and that kind of thing? I get so angry, but it seems like maybe anger by its nature entails some kind of attribution of agency.
Yeah, it's possible. Like I would say that likely many cases of the type of anger you're describing, anger at an inanimate object or at the weather or something like this, something clearly that's not an agent. I think for most of us, most like normal adults, it probably is a common thing to have part of you actually like, it seems to you that the thing is an agent, like in the movie Office Space, when they take out the printer and they like beat it with baseball bats and stuff. Like, you know, I think when you have that experience with a piece of technology, like part of you is like, you know, in a way it seems to you that it's an agent. And obviously that's a weird thing. But I also think that this type of anger, I think you brought it up because it's a good illustration of what's kind of bizarre about anger and unhealthy. And if you notice, like Shoemaker calls this goal frustration anger, where it's not a matter of like a moral judgment of wrongdoing. It's just like your goal is being frustrated, and like you're stuck in traffic or whatever, you have this anger response. But notice that like that can be accurately appraising the situation. Like your goal really is being frustrated. And so we might even say that it's fitting in a certain respect, but that doesn't vindicate it. Like we should not act like toddlers when things don't go the way we want. So I think that's actually useful for showing how we shouldn't be so open to anger being a good thing.
Yeah. So like if it's irrational with regard to the inanimate object, maybe it's irrational with regard to people too.
Yeah. At the very least, it's like, I think this undermines the suggestion that, well, if the emotion appraises things accurately, then there's this epistemic value, it's fitting. And so we can't say that it's irrational. Well, I think it, with goal frustration, anger, I'm appraising everything correctly, but I should also stop having this response where I act like a toddler. I should be able to do the appraising of the situation. I should be able to judge that my goal is being frustrated without having this feeling of wanting to smash the printer or you know, go cause problems for all the people who are, you know, causing this traffic jam. I just think that that's not, it's not vindicated by the fact that it has the accurate appraisal.
What you're saying is that anger involves a withdrawal of goodwill from someone. And your view is that there's always something bad about that. But even if we consider like a less extreme view, like we might think of the way that might usually be bad, right? Like maybe there are people where we really should just totally withdraw goodwill from them. But like most of the cases, most of the time, that isn't the case. Like, even if somebody is like rude to me, or I don't know exactly what that other person was experiencing in that moment, what their day's been like, you know, what they perceived me to have been like, I tend to sort of lean against retributivism just on the consideration that we are often ignorant about excusing or mitigating factors.
Yeah, that's right. And the Stoics talk about that. You never really know what someone's, I think Marcus Aurelius talks about this, like you can't be sure what their intentions were. And you also can't really be sure all of the myriad circumstances that led to them engaging in that behavior. You also can't be sure how you would have reacted if you had that, like all their same life experiences and found yourself in the exact same circumstances. Like there's so much uncertainty there that I think it really undercuts the legitimacy of having any sort of hostility or animosity towards another person. And I take it to the extreme that I think you would not go as far as I go, where I would apply this even to the worst, whoever the worst person on earth is, I would apply this to them as well. And I don't want to be angry at them, but at the very least, I think a lot of people might be sympathetic to the idea that in general, we need to be a lot more tolerant and sympathetic and generous in our interpretation of someone else's behavior and the circumstances that led to it.
Yeah. I mean, that's true. As far as describing anger as sort of like toddler-like, I don't know if that applies to some of these cases, or at least not obviously, like being angry at people for doing really, really horrible things. Do you remember this, the Charleston massacre, where this guy went into a black church and killed 9 people? The shooter, whose name I'm not going to say, was in jail for like 6 months or 4 months or something. He had all that time to reflect on his actions, and they found his diary, and he said that he pitied himself and he had no sympathy for the innocent people he killed. And he actually called them innocent people. He said, "I killed innocent people. I don't feel sorry for them. I feel sorry for myself because I'm in prison now." And I like thought I was going to explode with rage when I read that, you know. I thought, you know, whatever qualms I've developed about the death penalty have just gone out the window. Let's fry this bastard now, was my reaction. I don't know. That doesn't seem toddler-like to me. Maybe it's misguided. But you've got to do a lot of philosophy, I think, to convince me that that's like a very foolish reaction.
Yeah. So I should clarify, like the toddler pejorative was more about the goal frustration anger, where it's you're angry at the traffic jam or the printer or the weather, like things that are not agents. So I wouldn't say like the toddler thing about anger in the case of like sort of moral anger, where there's anger, where there's a moral judgment of wrongdoing. I don't think that it's that bad, but I still am deeply skeptical of it. And I grant that, like, when you describe that case, it's a very normal reaction. It's the typical human reaction to say, okay, this person is a bastard and I want to make him suffer, and I don't, and I have this anger response. But my view now is that the better response is to have pity for this person, to feel sorry for him. Like, as Epictetus says, like, the most important thing is having your moral bearings. Like, that's the most important thing for your flourishing. And this person you're describing has completely lost them, like, as bad as anybody can lose them. Like, in a way, he's in the most wretched human condition imaginable. And when I think about it in those terms, I actually feel sorry for him. And you know, you can think about, okay, well, at some point, this was an innocent child, and he had certain genetics, and he was growing up in an environment, neither of which, he didn't choose either of those things. And certain things happened along the way to lead him down this path, including, you know, making bad choices. But still, it's like there's so much bad luck involved in that whole process that wanting to get revenge against him for having wound up in this really depraved condition just seems like it's an excessive, cruel way to look at it. And I don't need to look at it that way. And what I can do instead is hope for him to flourish, wish that by some miracle he could reform. And if he can't, well, then we've got to punish him in the way for the sake of deterring other people from doing this and for protecting society. And we got to do everything we can to help the victims. We got to take all these good actions, but none of those actions require any loss of goodwill or not viewing this person as a fellow human being that I still ultimately hope that he could somehow flourish.
That's a good point. I mean, I have been moving over the last few years towards like a Socratic conception of evil, where ultimately it's sort of epistemic. Ultimately, I mean, Socrates' view was that all evil was ignorance, and I wouldn't go that far. But I would say that an awful lot of evil, including extreme evil, is ignorance and misguidedness. And when you look at extreme evildoers, they often fall into one of two categories. So one category is you've got people who are like psychopaths, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer and Ted Bundy and people like this. And such people, it seems like they really have no connection with the good. They are just fundamentally missing out on morality. They don't get it. And it seems like they don't have much choice over this. Maybe they have made some choices to amplify these tendencies in themselves. I don't know. But they certainly seem like they are just a certain way, and that inclines them to do horrifically evil things. And that should, I think, mitigate our retributive tendencies against us. So I don't know if you saw like the Ted Bundy tapes, the movie on Netflix.
No, I saw the thing with Zac Efron. Was that the same thing? Was he in a Ted Bundy thing, or was he playing somebody else?
No, he was playing Ted Bundy. I didn't care for that. I thought they kind of glorified him in a weird way in that movie.
Yeah.
So it's a documentary. It was a psychiatrist who had interviewed him, and they had these tapes and these confessions. But anyway, the day before, or maybe it was the actual day of his execution, there were a bunch of people who were outside prison who were like celebrating that he was going to be killed. You know, they had little electric chair pins because that was the method of his execution. And they were shouting, "Burn, Bundy, burn." And like, look, this guy murdered, I think, 36 women and raped a bunch of people and beheaded a 12-year-old girl. Like, this guy did sick, horrible things and would have continue to do those things if he were free to. So that kind of extreme anger and desire to harm him, you know, is totally understandable. And it was understandable that they didn't have this attitude that tragically what society must do with someone like that is to kill them. it was like this enthusiasm, like, we are delighted this guy is going to be electrocuted. I do think that, as understandable as that is, it's not truly an enlightened perspective. And you can start to see that when you imagine anybody who goes as wrong as Ted Bundy went, there's got to be something there that made morality harder to grasp, whether it's genetic or what. But that's got to mitigate some of that, I would think. So that covers one kind of case. Like, a lot of people who are extremely evil and do extremely wicked things are just not in touch with morality in a way that should mitigate our judgments of them.
Yeah, I think that's right. And again, like, to me, it helps to make a comparison to alternative responses that you might have to Bundy. So instead of like dancing in the streets and being overjoyed that he's about to be electrocuted to death, you could say, this whole thing is just a huge tragedy. And I hate the fact that he did what he did. And I also hate the fact that he's about to experience a ton of agony. And what I would ultimately want is for him to somehow become able to grasp the badness of what he did and to actually have the, somehow get good character. Like, if that were possible, I would always wish that for him. And that just seems like, you know, that's how I think Socrates would have responded. That's how a lot of great moral exemplars would have responded. And I don't see why that's not a better approach. And I just don't see, like, what's good about having that anger, retaliation response. Like, I don't see anything intrinsically valuable. People try to say that, well, it's got this epistemic value because you're appreciating the badness of what he did. But again, I don't think that that's plausible, because I can appreciate the badness with other emotional responses. So why, what good is coming out of having this anger response that has this withdrawal of goodwill from a fellow human being, a lack of pity, a lack of compassion? And also, it's disturbing of my own psychology in a way. Like, people who are susceptible to having that really strong anger response and people who become delighted by somebody being electrocuted to death, like, your own psychology is now, I think, you know, disturbed in a problematic way. So, yeah, I'm just extremely skeptical.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I think saying, I pity him that he's about to be electrocuted, and I pity him most of all that he's led such a horrible life and done such a horrible thing, such horrible things, that does not seem to miss out on any important element of morally what's going on here.
Yeah, if losing your anger meant that you could not recognize the badness of what he did, and you could not be like strongly motivated to prevent people like him from doing that, and strongly motivated to, you know, help victims of you know, really bad actions like that. If you couldn't have these motivations and judgments, then fine, we have to have anger. And so it's true that anger does play those roles for most of us as a sort of default, but we can get those goods via these other means, and these other means don't seem to have the same problems as anger. So, I mean, to me, that it's clear as day that, yeah, try to become the sort of person who cares about the badness of what he did and cares about protecting innocent people without having to have this response of animosity, or being the type of person who would be delighted by the fact that somebody is about to go to the electric chair.
So what I was saying is, I want to pose, it's a kind of dilemma. It's like, take any kind of extreme evildoer you like. Maybe this doesn't cover absolutely all of them, but it covers many of them. So you've got extreme evildoers like Ted Bundy, where it seems like there are real questions about whether or not they understand morality at all. There are real questions about whether they have any epistemic access to morality at all. And then you've got another kind of evildoer, moral extremists. So the Charleston shooter is an example of a moral extremist. I actually did read his manifesto. He's convinced of his racist ideology. He believes that he was acting for the benefit of humanity or something like that. It was really convinced of this, apparently. There are lots and lots of people of different ideologies who are similar in that way. Namely, they have these extremely misguided moral beliefs, and then they act on them and they don't question them sufficiently. And I think with those people too, there are sort of things that would mitigate against a retributivist attitude or would make us more inclined to pity them rather than to wish them harm. At least my inclination is once I sort of see somebody as someone who is actually trying to do something good and was extremely mixed up about it, I'm inclined to think that we should judge them less harshly or be less inclined to want to harm them, punish them, that sort of thing. And I think this extends even to like the most extreme kind of evildoers who have an ideology that they're acting on. And so here are these two kinds of evildoers. You've got the Ted Bundy types. They don't have a moral ideology. They just are absent from morality. They have no moral faculty or whatever. And then you've got these people who are really, really extreme moralists of a kind, but they're extremely misguided about the content of morality and what it means for them. And in either case, I think that sort of mitigates against like wanting to harm them. It mitigates against retributivism. So that's kind of what I'm thinking.
Yeah, that all sounds plausible to me. I guess one question I would have about this, I mean, I think that's a good way of thinking about it, but did you have thoughts on what I said earlier about this possibility that you could be a type of anti-anger retributivist where you do believe that like in this cosmic justice sense, it is necessary for those bad actors to be punished, even though at the same time, part of you deeply regrets that they have to be punished and you wish this wasn't the case and you don't take any sort of delight in their suffering in sort of a payback way. It's just a matter of like, you know, like a Kantian style cosmic justice. Do you think you could have that without the anger the way that I'm thinking might be possible?
Well, I mean, I think if justice actually demands that some people suffer, what would be wrong in delighting in justice, right? What would be wrong in delighting the execution of justice if it really requires that people be drawn and quartered and stuff like that? I kind of think like, yeah, there's a possible view there in logical space, but I think if it's true, justice demands that people suffer, then why not rejoice in it? And also, why is it so bad that we have emotions that incline us toward rejoicing in this aspect of justice? It just seems like it would weaken your case considerably.
Possibly. I mean, it might be the case that I do need to go all the way towards anti-retributivism, which I'm happy to do because, again, this cosmic justice idea I have in my mind, I am not sympathetic to. And I think retributivism is just a colossal problematic vestige of our evolutionary history that we need to overcome. But I do, like, for the sake of trying to make my position like amenable to as many people as possible, I was hoping to make it compatible with the type of retributivism. So I guess my thought is that, like, if I'm this type of retributivist that I'm imagining, it's like, yes, I love justice and my preference is that the just punishment be delivered, but that preference is also like the delight, any possible delight in having that preference satisfied is just completely overwhelmed by my regret that the person is in the position of deserving this suffering and that they have to suffer. You know what I mean? Like, I'm still mostly just like, this sucks. I like imagine like a judge who like, you know, feels very sorry for the person who's been convicted, you know, just feels like, I have to sentence this person to this punishment, but like, I wish I didn't have to. That's a type of retributivist that doesn't, like, I don't have to have anger when I am sort of saying that it would be better if that punishment happened. But like, there's still like, overall, I could feel like I have this non-anger attitude towards the person.
Yeah, that makes sense. So that does make sense. I have suggested to you a number of times, I'm toying with this view. This is worth a paper at some point. Maybe it's already been worked out. I'm not sure. A view that's, I don't know if it's a quasi-retributivist view or if it's just if it's a non-retributivist view or if it's a halfway house. But I think there are certain kinds of moral betterment that require suffering. Like you can't improve or repent until you have an appreciation of the harm that you've caused and the bad that you've done. And that is unavoidably painful. So I kind of would like there to be a purgatory. I mean, I don't think this actually exists, but I would like to see that this exists, that there's a kind of purgatory where people like Joseph Stalin would have to empathize with all of the people they've harmed and have a total appreciation of how bad they've been for a long time. And I think, good, that's exactly what should happen to Stalin. Stalin should experience life through the eyes of like a poor peasant woman. I think that would be great. I think Stalin should experience that. And I'm kind of delighted at the thought of him having to experience that. But the ultimate justification for it is that at the end of this purgatory, he would be able to repent. You know, so you could have a kind of universalism. If we're talking about theology, everyone's eventually saved, and that's how it should be. But there is still like a kind of retributivist component. Like there's a kind of wishing the other person well that requires that they be harmed in the short term, and you can wish that for them legitimately.
Yeah, right. I'm very sympathetic to that. I think that's a really interesting idea. And I'm all for a punishment if the goal of it, part of the goal of it, is to actually help that person improve. And it's constructive for them. It's going to help them flourish and become a better person. I think that that's perfectly fine. I also am sympathetic to punishment for the sake of deterrence, perhaps. I'm less sympathetic when it's about getting payback against them. I guess part of what I think is going on here is like I've started to accept like a more eudaimonist conception of well-being, where it's this sort of overall flourishing. Like my life goes well, a big part of my life going well is having good ethical commitments and virtues and those sorts of things. And so when I think about it with that conception of well-being, it's like obvious to me that I would want the person to have some of those unpleasant experiences only because they are ultimately good for that person in the long run.
Right, right. But that, I mean, sometimes you can't be thinking about like the cosmic good like before your mind all the time. You have to think about your reactions to what's in front of you, even as a means to the cosmic good. So it might be totally appropriate that, you know, the best means to that involves taking an angrier, like retributivist sort of stance right now. I mean, that seems possible, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly possible. And like the empirical question becomes really complicated. It's definitely possible that like, again, like you need to punishment and you need to like express really strong disapproval of this action. You need to denounce it. I'm still skeptical that anger, the actual anger response is going to be what's most conducive, especially again. And then if you think about like all of the negative externalities of anger in terms of causing cycles of retaliation and revenge and like deepened animosity between people and your tendency to get carried away in your anger, to me, it just seems like a safer strategy. And the goal in my mind is to become the type of person who I express really strong disapproval and I take appropriate action and I try to defend the vulnerable or people who are oppressed. And I try to pursue just outcomes without ever letting the anger creep in. Like it's always sort of positive and forward looking and loving and generous rather than being a matter of any sort of revenge or payback.
So like suppose though that you had godlike control over your own faculties, that you could flip on anger and turn it off immediately when you see it's no longer useful for you. Like you could like, you know, denounce the evildoers with this thundering blast and really be angry at them and then turn it off when it's no longer of use to you. So I grant that like people in general aren't able to do this. Like if something pisses me off, I'm going to remain pissed off long after it's doing me any kind of good. And that's a significant consideration for just maybe not getting so angry to begin with. But if we're talking about like the intrinsic nature of anger and its status, it's worth considering, like, what if we had like a higher degree of control and we could become unangry in an instant?
That's good. That's a good challenge. So I still think that like the animosity that's going to be inherent to it is there's still the intrinsic disvalue there. And I think we can also do what Seneca suggests, which is if you're dealing with someone who's not going to get the message unless they see you getting angry, then you can fake being angry. You can sort of, you know, do a performance and of, you know, having this deep hostility towards them without actually having it. So that's one type of intrinsic disvalue, though, the sort of animosity. I also think I'm sympathetic to the Stoic view and this view that's in Eastern philosophy as well about the value of tranquility and not letting yourself sort of become agitated by these external events. And I do feel like when I get angry, like I've sort of lost my tranquility and I've sort of failed in a way to have that sort of inner citadel that the Stoics talk about, where like, okay, this happened, but I'm not going to have this affective response where I'm hot and full of anger. I'm just going to see what's going on and be guided by positive emotions and reason rather than having the anger response. I think that's still a better way, even if we're considering this case you're talking about where I have access to a switch where I can turn off the anger after a short amount of time.
Wouldn't the kind of Stoic inner citadel, emphasis on tranquility, wouldn't that perspective also mitigate against like really strong positive emotions as well?
Yeah, this is a worry that people have. And I think there's something to it. Like, I do think so as I interpret the Stoic position and like, you know, there's disagreement among different Stoics, like historically speaking, and even like among Neo-Stoics, there's disagreement, of course. But the way I think about this is there's a certain type of positive emotional response that is problematic because it's like you become too overwhelmed by, you're like carried away with joy about something, especially if it's the wrong sort of thing. Like if you're carried away with joy by some professional achievement or something, or if you're so madly in love that you have this deep attachment to the person that it would completely ruin you if they died, I feel like those sorts of, you know, positive emotions are problematic. Same thing with sympathy. Like if I'm so sympathetic to you and so like intertwined with you that like I would be strongly tempted to help you get away with something unjust, like that's another danger of what's typically a positive emotion. But I do think that like a sort of Stoicism is perfectly compatible with a sort of, you know, love that's not excessive and attached and taking sort of delight in other people and our relationships with them, and having a love of virtue and having a certain level of sympathy and compassion. I think those things are compatible, but there has to be this discipline to not let them become excessive. There's room to say that there's less concern about being carried away with some of these positive emotions than there is with something like anger, where anger also has this intrinsic sort of animosity built in.
Right. So it still seems like you want to say there's an asymmetry there. Like you still want to say that warm or positive emotions you can have the right amount of, but anger, like there's no amount of it that's good. You should get rid of it.
Yeah, partly because of the claim about the intrinsic disvalue of the animosity. And I think something, so there again, I've mentioned two types of intrinsic disvalue. There's the animosity / withdrawal of goodwill, and there's also the loss of tranquility and the sort of failing to keep up your inner citadel. And I think the positive emotions, some of them at least, don't have the intrinsic disvalue of animosity, obviously. And I also think that they're not like the same type of disturbance. Like if I take a little bit of delight in this conversation and our friendship, I don't feel like I'm, you know, agitated and disturbed the same way I am when something on Twitter makes me angry. You know what I mean? Like it's just sort of, I still feel like I'm kind of not being carried away or led away by anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so going back to like defenses of anger, one of the more interesting ones is Frederick Douglass said that at one point, I think it was in his response to the Fugitive Slave Act, Black people needed to be angry about the way they were being treated and, you know, assert themselves as a kind of a countermeasure for being seen as overly docile and overly forgiving. And, you know, given the enormity of slavery, that made a lot of sense, I think. The thought was that at least it might not be like a good state to be in continually, but it could have been that there were certain circumstances that make it like a good, morally legitimate, and perhaps even necessitated measure for a given set of circumstances. In the same way that chopping off limbs isn't good, but we can think of circumstances where like it's the best option.
Yeah.
So what do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a good case. And I'm open to this possibility. So I think there are going to be circumstances where a person or a group of people, they don't have the sort of dispositions and resources to achieve their ends without anger. So what I'm advocating is cultivating ourselves in a way that we can get motivated to stand up for ourselves and other people who are being oppressed and fight vigorously if we have to, all the while without having an anger response. And I grant that that's something that's far away from most of us as we currently are. It's like a long-term project or a long-term goal that I think we ought to strive for. But if someone's in a situation where the way that they're currently constituted, their only means of like becoming properly motivated and taking appropriate action, like the only source of motivation available to them is their anger, well, then I might have to say that I'm glad that they had their anger there and it was a good thing that they were able to respond to it. I would still say, though, that the best way for a human being to be is to become the sort of person where they're capable of taking the right action and being motivated, even without anger, the way some of, in my view, the greatest moral exemplars in history were.
Right, right. So do you think it's possible to, if you're encouraging a group of people to give the right kind of response, it's possible to bypass, it's not like we need to go through an anger stage and then we can like kick away the ladder and achieve this higher moral plane. Do you think we can teach people, educate people to bypass it entirely and just immediately go to the most enlightened possible response?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. It's a tough empirical question. And of course, like everyone's going to have already had lots of experiences of anger when they start this process. So yeah, I'm not sure what to say about that. But I guess the claim that I'm most committed to is that it should be the goal to arrive at a state where I'm able to have all the epistemic and motivational benefits of anger without having to rely on anger. The process of getting there, I'm not sure, and whether like it's possible to get there without, you know, fully feeling a lot of anger and experiencing it and expressing it, I'm not sure. But I do think that it's possible to get there. And I think that there are, you know, existence proofs of this. Like, I do think people like Socrates and, you know, even some of the great movements for justice, people like Martin Luther King and people like Nelson Mandela, like there was a strong anti-anger element to their message. And I think that's what made it so powerful. So, of course, for most human beings, like it's a super strong, you know, thing. It's super deep within us, this susceptibility to anger. And it's not easy, but I do think it's a worthwhile goal.
Well, one thing I've noticed is that there's a kind of popular pro-social justice glorification of anger, and not just anger, other emotions too.
Yep.
But it's almost as if you're supposed to be angry at the police, for example.
Right.
And if you're not, you don't care, or you don't care enough, or something like that. Coupled with that is this thought that anger for the cause of social justice could not be epistemically distorting. It's like a pure 100% benefit with no distortion added. which just seems to me like this could not be true given what we know about human psychology, right? I mean,
yeah. Yeah, so this is one of the reasons why I think the general pro-anger view, and it's I think within academic philosophy, the recent literature on anger is overwhelmingly pro-anger. And I think there is a strong social justice element to that or motivation behind it. And I think a lot of this comes from the fact that we distinguish between fitting and unfitting anger. So if the target of my anger didn't do anything wrong, there was no transgression there, then obviously that anger is problematic. It's irrational in a way, it's not fitting. On the other hand, if the target of my anger actually did do something wrong, well, then we say, oh, well, that's fitting. There's an accurate appraisal there. But the mistake that we make, I think, is by going from the fact that it's a fitting response in the sense of having this accurate appraisal and it's the typical response to wrongdoing. We slide from that to the conclusion that it's the fitting response, the only fitting response, and it's just the way that you ought to respond to any wrongdoing or injustice. And that's where I think the problem arises, because it's simply not true that it's the only way to appraise injustice and be motivated to fight against it. But this is what leads people to think that, oh, you're not angry, then you don't really care, or you're not really committed to the cause, or you don't really want to fight against injustice. It's like, no, I do care about those things. I can just do that without being full of anger. And that's the part of the message that I'm trying to get out there, is it's not a choice between anger and apathy or anger and indifference. It's a false dichotomy.
Right, right. I had said in one of our earlier conversations what I thought was a good reductio ad absurdum against the fittingness defense. Like, there are certain things that are fitting in a way that are like not normatively significant. The example I had in mind was calling you a racial slur that's the racial slur for your race. Like, the fact that it's like not some different race. So I get it's fitting in some thin sense.
Right, right. But you have to consider more than just, like, the assessment of that usage has to include, it's broader than merely, is it sort of getting something correct in its usage?
Yeah, that's right.
And that's, so, yeah, right. That's a good analogy. And we talked last time about envy as a good way of illustrating the problem with the fittingness defense. And I mentioned this in my paper on anger. You know, envy involves this appraisal that someone else has something good that I wish that I had. And I often experience envy. It's a natural response. And sometimes it's appraising correctly insofar as, like, what the other person has really is something good that I would like to have. Like, if my colleague gets a promotion that I was hoping to get, or you publish another paper and I haven't published anything in a while, and it's like, I feel, you know, as I begrudgingly like your Facebook post about it, I'm still feeling this tinge of envy. And to me, like, this is something that most people, I think, agree, this is a problematic feature of ourselves, and we would do better to cultivate it away. But it's still fitting in this sense, and that shows that fittingness isn't enough to fully vindicate an emotional response if there's other things about that response that we think might be intrinsically disvaluable. And in the case of envy, it's sort of this self-focus and not being loving, and I should be happy for you instead of focused on my relative lack. So there's intrinsic disvalue there. And that overrides the fact that, well, there's this accurate appraisal of the fact that you have something good. And I think a similar argument applies in the case of anger.
What would you say then should we do about anger, like, in ourselves? Like, have you discovered any effective way to reduce the amount of anger you've got?
Yeah, I mean, it's good. Like, I've been trying to improve myself with respect to my emotions a lot over recent years. And especially, I guess, like the past 2 years. And I think I've had a lot of success, but I'm a little bit cautious about saying that, because I've also realized I've had virtually nothing bad happen to me over recent years. And so, like, I don't know if it's just like I haven't been tested properly. And maybe if I have the proper test, I'll find out that I haven't made as much progress as I think I have. But in terms of, like, what I've been doing, meditation, mindfulness meditation is one thing. And I'm not good at meditation. It's super hard, but I think that that's helping a little bit. I use Sam Harris's meditation app, Waking Up, which I think is fantastic. It's the best one I've tried. And also, like, the lessons that are included in that app and the conversations I find very helpful. Also, I do like daily readings of the Stoics. And to me, there is a noticeable difference. Like if I read, if I'm the periods, the time periods where I'm reading Epictetus literally every morning, it's hard to know for sure. Maybe it's all like in my imagination, but I do feel like starting my day by reading that stuff just makes me handle things better during the day. Like having those lessons and the arguments deep in my mind. And some of those lessons are things that we've talked about today about sort of, you know, keeping in mind my own flaws, keeping in mind how unfortunate it is to become a corrupt individual and how much luck is involved in everything. And how, you know, as Marcus says, like I have a duty to my fellow human beings to still love them despite all of their flaws. I just feel like reading those things and reminding myself of them, that's another helpful technique. There's also techniques that are used by psychologists in things like, you know, anger management or behavioral therapy, like framing effects, like learning to frame things differently and try to have, you know, charitable interpretations of other people's motives instead of always assuming the worst. And also like changing your values. I feel like what makes us susceptible to anger oftentimes is putting too much value on things like social status and generally external things like how much, you know, like my material possessions, for example. If something gets stolen from me and I'm obsessed with my material possessions, then I'm more likely to be angry. But if I'm less attached to those things, then it's much easier to avoid anger. So those are just some of my thoughts on that.
Yeah. Well, when you talk about like framing, could you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So there's this book called The Stoic Challenge by William Irvine. I don't know if it's Irvine or Irvin, but yeah. So The Stoic Challenge is a lot about framing. And so, for example, like when something bad happens to you or something that seems bad that you weren't hoping to happen, instead of like thinking, okay, this is really unfair, this should never have happened to me, how could that person have done this to me? You can frame it as, this is an opportunity for me to see how much progress I've made in my commitment to becoming like a tolerant, patient, loving person. And let me see if I can respond to this. In the book, he talks about it as like a test from the Stoic gods or like an imaginary personal life coach. And when you frame it that way, like I have found this to be effective. There was a time a few years ago when I moved to this apartment and my bike had been stolen, like in the process of moving things, like I left my bike outside and I stupidly didn't lock it. And like, I made the decision rather quickly that like, I'm going to try right now to not get angry about this and have a positive attitude about it. Like that became my focus. And it immediately, like, not only did I not feel angry and sad and frustrated all day, I actually had this kind of feeling of euphoria because I was so proud of myself that I was actually keeping a good attitude about this and having the right thoughts and succeeding in that way. And so to me, that's some evidence that these sorts of techniques can be quite effective.
So yeah, this is something I was thinking about the other day, quite independently, although I've not been able to put it to such productive use, I've got to say. But it occurred to me that just about everything is either like things are going well for you, which is great, or you're being tested in a way that you have an opportunity to prove yourself, even in like small inconveniences and things like that. For me, like, I don't know if you've realized this, but I think I'm the least patient person in the world. I can't stand to wait for anything.
No.
Well, if I don't know how long I'm going to wait, like it just, even if it's 30 seconds, drives me nuts.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try to take the opportunity to see this as like, okay, well, either things are going the way I want or I'm being tested and I've got the opportunity to try to build up a sense of resilience against this. I'm going to try to see how far that takes me. I think I've gotten a little bit better about it.
Yeah, man, I'm a huge proponent of this. And I mean, even as you describe it, it's like, how could this not be a good strategy? It just seems like such a great way to I'm not saying it's going to work every time, but it certainly seems worth a shot. I have one other example. For the holidays last year, when, you know, I was still able to travel overseas, I flew from Melbourne to Los Angeles. And I don't mind those flights so much, but it is a long flight. And when you get off the plane, like, you're extremely tired and sort of disoriented and a little bit cranky. And our flight got in late. And the airport, LAX, was like chaotic and things were not running smoothly. And it became clear that most of us were going to miss our connections. And I was supposed to just have like, you know, 60 minutes in Los Angeles and then a short flight to Phoenix and then see my parents, take a long nap and be very happy. But I found out that, okay, you're going to have a connection somewhere. And I immediately like thought to myself, okay, here we go. Like, this is what you've been waiting for, a chance to like test your training and see, can you have a good attitude about this and proceed accordingly. And so when I got up to the counter, finally, the woman who was working there, who I've been watching people be like extremely angry with her and like so mad at her, even though it clearly like none of this was her fault. And I went up there and she's like, oh, I'm so sorry. You're going to have to, you know, wait here for 3 hours and then fly to San Francisco and wait there for a couple hours and then fly to Phoenix. And what I said to her was like, oh, you know, that's okay. Like, none of this is your fault. And I think I've been watching. I think you've done a really great job trying to handle all this. And I, again, like what I would have done before I started getting really into Stoicism is like, I would have had the same reaction as everybody else. And I probably did in similar situations in my life. But this, again, not only did it make me not feel terrible and like have the usual grumpy, angry response, I felt good about myself. Like I knew that I had done something good and I could tell that she really appreciated that. And so to me, that again shows that these sorts of techniques can actually make a difference. And if nothing else, it'll make you have a better day. But I also think it can sort of spread positive energy to other people.
You've inspired me. You've legitimately inspired me. I'm going to try to do better at this. I don't think I would have handled that nearly as well as you did it from the what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, the only I have to give full credit to William Irvin from his book, The Stoic Challenge, because the first chapter of that book is about like an airport scenario that was like very similar. And I had just read it not too long ago. So it was like so fresh in my mind that like, okay, this is a chance to try it out. And man, it was great. Like I told my friends, I told my mom, like I was like so happy. Like I felt like I had done something really good, like for myself and for someone else. And it wasn't that hard and it made the whole day better. So yeah, I give the credit to Bill Irvin. That sort of technique, I think, is in the ancient Stoics, but he does a really good job of sort of making it digestible for modern readers.
We said we might want to say a little bit about fear.
Sure.
The case for fear is kind of similar to the case against fear, rather. The case for it being a bad thing is similar to the case for anger being a bad thing, but there are some differences. So why don't you explain?
Yeah, I mean, similarities, like I do think just the fact of being psychologically disturbed. And again, I think when you feel fear, that's another way in which you sort of let the enemy into your inner citadel. And I think there's some disvalue there. I also think that with fear, there's a failure of self-mastery, but this depends on how I conceive of fear. So I think that when you're actually in a state of fear, you're having a motivation to avoid something that seems threatening to you that is inherently not completely under the discipline of your reason. So I see something scary and I have this motivation to avoid it, but even if it actually is dangerous, and so I'm appraising it correctly, once I come to the conclusion that in this case, I actually need to confront the danger, that's what the right thing to do is, I'm still going to have some sort of inner struggle. And I think the fact that I have to have this inner struggle, there's something already problematic about that. I think the goal is to be, again, more like Socrates, where, okay, I judge that thing's dangerous, like say it's a tiger or something, and usually I should avoid tigers, but once I see that, you know, there's a child who needs to be rescued, I don't have to do any inner struggle and fight against my fear response. Like, I'm just ready to go. Like, I've made the judgment and then my motivations line up with that perfectly. I feel like that's the ideal way to be. And lately, I've been putting it more in terms of the virtue of fearlessness. I used to present it more about fear being a vice. And I feel like I believe that, but it's like a little bit too strong and people sometimes interpret it in a way that I don't want them to. But I think it's better to think about the truly virtuous agent, the Stoic sage, isn't going to have a genuine fear response. They're going to be prudent and cautious and desire to avoid things. But when they see that the right thing to do is to confront this danger, they don't have to worry about any inner struggle to try to overcome this impulse to avoid, it's like they're just ready to go.
Yeah. So how would you understand courage or courageousness on this account, right? Because on Aristotle's account, the courageous person has the right amount of fear. But if fear is bad, then you can't understand courage in that way.
Yes. Yeah, so I think there is a virtue called courage, which is pretty similar to the conventional understanding where, okay, I haven't cultivated away my disposition to fear, and I'm having a fear response, and I'm having this internal struggle, but I win that struggle, and I still go and confront the danger. I think that's great. That's admirable. That's excellent. I just think that it's even more excellent if you could have been fearless and not even had to have had the inner struggle.
So the courageous person, it's a kind of continence.
Yeah. Right?
So Aristotle, on his schema, he says, so you've got the virtuous person who just sort of like spontaneously does the right thing, and that's the way to be. But on the way to getting there, you've got continence. You've got the impulse not to do the right thing, but you control yourself and you get through it. And so the courageous person gets through the fear and runs into battle anyway, for example. Whereas you would say the fearless person is the virtuous person, not the continent person. The fearless person doesn't even feel the temptation to flee or something.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And do you have any specific advice for achieving fearlessness, or is it similar to the anger advice?
Yeah, a lot of it is very similar. So I think, again, like with meditation, I mean, a lot of this has to do with like your attachments to things. So I'm going to be the most prone to fear when I'm like extremely attached to my body and also to like my possessions, to my loved ones, and also to the story about my life that I'm telling myself. And I feel like meditation is a way to cut through a lot of those attachments and to cut through the story that you tell yourself, and to be sort of, you know, more capable of maintaining tranquility even in volatile circumstances. Then again, too, like I think Stoic readings are quite useful for this. And there's also exercises you can do. And again, with if you think about the way clinical psychology works, when you're dealing with someone who has a phobia or some sort of anxiety disorder, you do exposure therapy. So you can actually practice getting used to the thing that you're afraid of. So if you have a fear of elevators, for example, like riding an elevator, well, you can start by like watching videos of elevators going up and down. And then you can go practice getting in an elevator and then getting off right away until you get ready to like get in and actually go up. And exposure therapy has been shown to actually work. And I think that can be used in sort of a broader way where it's a matter of like exposing myself to situations that I'm not comfortable in, where it does seem a little bit dangerous or I do feel really uncomfortable. You know, the fear of public speaking, like everybody has that. But as you probably know, like when I first had to give philosophy talks, there was nothing I could imagine that was more terrifying. But after you do it enough times, it becomes like a really fun, awesome thing. And you could have similar things with physical things. Like I've been doing jujitsu lately, and I feel like I'm guessing that I'll be less worried about physical altercations now that I've been forcing myself 2 days a week to get choked out by other people and be extremely uncomfortable. Like I just feel like these sorts of practical things in the case of fear can also be quite useful.
I discovered when I was in the Army that I could make fear go away just by focusing on the belief that I had to do what they were telling me to do. There was a time when I was in a convoy and somebody had thrown something into the field that they thought was a bomb, thrown it from a motorcycle, and it was in a hostile village. And so they said, okay, get out, everybody, we're going to sweep through this, like I think it was like tall grass or something, and find the bomb. And my first inclination was like, yeah, I don't want to have anything to do with that. But then I told myself, nope, you got to do it. And we went out and they actually didn't find anything. But I was struck by the thought that like just the thought that I've got to do it made the fear just go away.
Yeah.
It's yeah. Like it was just, like there really was a switch there that I had access to where it was like, no, I this is what I've got to do. And I haven't been able to find that switch for anger and frustration and for all sorts of other things. But I presume those things can be combated through a similar strategy.
Yeah, good. So that was a great example that you just gave. In that case, it seemed like, you know, your commitment to your duty was able to turn off the fear. I think in the case of anger, it could be similar, but it could just be like, remind yourself of your commitment to virtue, that virtue and your own having virtuous responses to things is way more important than anything else. And I think if you can do that, that's a very powerful way to sort of get yourself in check.
You know, I think we've covered the basis here. Is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I feel like we covered a lot of ground, and it's been a helpful conversation for me, and I've enjoyed it. So yeah, it's been good.
All right. Well, I hope you'll be a three-peat guest on this podcast too.
Yeah, no, I mean, I want to, because somebody's going to tie me with two soon, and I want to always, you know, get back out in front. So yeah, hopefully that can happen.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you later then.
Thanks, Spencer. Talk to you soon.